I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 204 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us, please go to caropop.com. Our guest this week runs a small reissues label that puts out definitive versions of great albums, Shane Bettner of Intervention Records. Intervention releases a lot fewer albums than, say, Rhino or Analog Productions, yet a relatively high percentage of them have wound up in my collection. When I want to show off my stereo system, I put on the percussion-popping Intervention pressing of Joe Jackson's Night and Day, mastered all analog by recurring Caro Pop guest Kevin Gray. I also own the excellent Intervention versions of Jackson's Look Sharp, Matthew Sweet's Girlfriend and Altered Beast, the Flying Burrito Brothers' Gilded Palace of Sin, Gene Clark's White Light, and the fantastic expedition of Dillard and Clark. When Peter Frampton was a guest on Caro Pop, we talked about his box for Intervention, Frampton at 50, in the studio 1972 to 1975. Intervention's albums are distinguished not only by their top-notch sourcing and mastering, but also heavyweight vinyl, pristine pressings, and extra attention paid to the artwork and packaging, including tip-on jackets sometimes upgraded to gatefolds. But running a high-end boutique label like this is not easy, as Bettner has learned in the 10 years since he launched it. There are licensing agreements to be negotiated and renewed, artists to please, mastering engineers, pressing plants, and distributors to be engaged, vinyl formulation and cover design to be discussed, plus changes in the marketplace and ever-increasing competition to be navigated. Bettner explains how much has changed since Intervention re-released the first two Steelers Wheel albums in the fall of 2015. With so many more labels jumping into the audiophile pool, has licensing recordings become harder for Intervention? What dictates pricing? Has he found that his customers care more about 180-gram vinyl or tip-on jackets? Bettner also is looking ahead, as Intervention has forged a new agreement to release all analog versions of classic Sun Records albums. The first one is the dance album of Carl Perkins, the singer-songwriter's 1958 debut that plays like a greatest hits album. It is shipping this month. Johnny Cash with his hot and blue guitar, which gave the world I Walk the Line and Folsom Prison Blues in 1957, ships in February. Both albums are short enough that Kevin Gray was able to master them at 45 RPM for an additional boost in sound quality. Bettner discusses how they pulled off that trick, as well as the Sun Records project in general. Bettner is refreshingly candid and passionate as he takes us inside the workings of Intervention Records. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Shane Bettner.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time.
I imagine it's tough to keep a business going like this when you have these awesome products, but like not this huge volume of them.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, that's really the toughest part about the business, right? I mean, I always joke with people about this. If the, you know, the vinyl reissue market, you know, the prices are more or less set kind of by a group of us, right? Like single 33s are 40 to 43. Three-ish, well, I guess anywhere from high 30s to low 40s, right? And then if you're doing double 45s or something like that, it's typically $55 to $60-ish, right? But if these products were at a typical cost of goods multiplier of, say, 7X, which is a very typical multiplier of like, okay, this is what it costs to make a product and then bring it to market, market it, run a brand, run a business and everything, but really don't get to do that. And, you know, we're competing with the labels themselves who don't have to pay themselves royalties and stuff like that. And yet the prices are kind of established and locked in. And yes, there's volume, but like, no, it's to your point, it's not crazy volume. And that is what makes, you know, the math of the business difficult. I always tell people I can make great records, can't make cheap, great records.
Well, there you go. And there's sort of an expectation now that this stuff has a cost associated with it, especially when it's presented the way you present it. I mean, like there are some that you'll get for, you know, like $30, which still sounds like a lot to a lot of people. But if you're looking at something with the sort of the nice jackets and the pressing and the and all of that stuff, I mean, I think that, you know, there's people understand they have to pay that much if it's going to be the definitive pressing of something, which is sort of what everyone's looking for.
Yeah, that's what I do. Obviously, it's our, you know, my sort of tagline is archive quality LPs of the music we love. I guess the question, and maybe I'm genuinely curious for your opinion. I mean, $30 to me in this day and age, you know, I can't hit a $30 price point, by the way. So I'm thinking more of things like, one of the things that I've taken an immense amount of joy in the last couple of years is what Blue Note is doing, for example, with the Classic series.
That's exactly what I was thinking about.
They're all analog by Kevin Gray. They aren't tip-on jackets. They're direct-to-board. They're pressed overseas at a great plant. I think they use Optimal. Those things are $30 or so. I think they're a steal. And I've really, really loved those. And these days, I don't know what you experience or other people, but if you're buying vintage records in a record store, you really can't get anything that's clean under $20-$25 these days. And there's lots of things that are more than 30 that are things where they pressed millions, right? Like, this is not a precious, unique snowflake where, or like an RL Led Zeppelin II or something really rare. It's more like, oh, this is a really clean vintage pressing from the 70s and it looks good. So it's going to be $25-$30.
Right.
So I'm, you know, that's a very interesting part of the market. I'm curious about the perception of that.
Blue Note, and again, Blue Note's part of Universal. It's a big company. Yeah. You got Don Was as the president. You have Kevin Gray doing the Classics and the Tone Poets with Joe Harley. Tone Poets are kind of more akin to what you're doing, where that's in the $40 price point, and it's the tip-on jackets and the, you know, just everything's a little bit higher level.
Yeah. Unequivocally.
But the Classics still sound pretty great compared to, you know, your average sort of digital vinyl repress that's also going to cost $30. So
exactly. And you know, it's very interesting. Yeah, the market kind of establishes those price points. And what's really interesting is a couple of years ago, you know, because everybody's experiencing some version of the same thing. During the pandemic, things went crazy. You know, we had all those capacity issues, which are really famous and have really gone away, but, you know, now thankfully. But a remnant of it is that all the costs went up, you know, the cost of jackets, the cost of, you know, the vinyl records themselves. In some very key instances, the other thing that's happened is royalty rates have gone up, even in licensing situations, which is kind of interesting, even in licensing and repressing stuff you've already done. So it's like, you know, nobody's sending tapes or spending anymore, but it's like, oh, okay, it's more expensive now for the same thing. I was looking for ways to, okay, I don't want my prices to go up too much more, and what can I do? So one of the things I've toyed with for years is the idea of starting to do at least some records at 150 gram regular weight, so to speak, so Got a Groove, where I press in Ohio, Matt Early and his team, they're great. I pressed at RTI for years. They made beautiful flat records, quiet records for me. No returns. Like, they're just, you know, the defect rates are low. For a variety of reasons, you know, I had to move. Got a Groove was where I always had in mind, like, hey, if I ever have to make a move here, I bought these guys' records before, and everything I get that says it was pressed at Got a Groove is amazing. And I've got a great relationship there. And Matt's been telling me, and RTI was telling me the same thing for a long time, that they could press great sounding 140, 150 gram records. So the regular weight at Got a Groove is 150 grams. And I started talking to, I've got a great group of people that follow my label on the Steve Hoffman forums, which has been an incredibly positive, uplifting place for me to interact with my fans of the label and stuff like that.
Right.
And I did the other thing I love is I crowdsource, you know, kind of polling information, opinions, like, hey, would you guys be interested in this? And if you were, like, would you pay this for it or that? So I went to them and I said, hey, I'm looking for ways to cut that. Like, what would you guys think of if I could do $35 records at 150 grams? And, you know, what if I did, you know, high-end direct-to-board jackets instead of the tip-ons? Because that is a place, you know, the bottom line is that, like, you know, between 150 gram and, you know, that, like, you'd be talking about shaving a couple of bucks off, which is a big deal, right? When you're talking about cost of goods. And it was very interesting. The gang was all unanimous. Now, again, like, these are my people, right?
Right.
These are the people who buy reissues, you know, they buy my stuff. They trust me. And they said, hey, 180, we don't think that 180 is any quieter or better sounding than 150. That we think is mostly marketing. But I got consistent feedback. Everybody said the same thing. If you start doing direct-to-board jackets, it's not a premium release anymore. And I was very surprised by that. I'll be honest, I expected people to say, I care about the sound and the music more than anything. I'd rather have 180 and a cheap jacket and, you know, you doing it. And it was never a question. I stay in the analog domain. Whenever the original source was analog tape, whenever possible, that's what we do. You know, again, if it's a digital source, it's a different story. And I mean the original source, right?
Right.
I mean, I do a lot of 90s stuff. And even, you know, I even did a Joe Jackson record from the 80s. It was an early digital source recording.
Body and soul.
Yeah. So, you know, that's the thing. I'm authentic to the source, not slavish about, okay, like, I'm not going to do something from the digital era because it's like, well, that's what the master is. That's what it is. But I was very surprised because I really expected more people to be like, no, you know, the sound's the biggest thing and the only thing. They're really, and I guess I'm not surprised because I, you know, I've always gotten feedback from people. I love the big album art. You know, people really appreciate the amount of time and attention I put into reproducing the album artwork.
Sure.
And I really, it's difficult. In fact, we've been, you know, going through these the last few weeks because I'm finally doing something that's a couple things we'll talk about later, I'm sure, that are like 70 years old. You know, my God, is that an interesting game to play to try to be authentic to the originals and do something that looks beautiful. And, you know, frankly, you're working from scans and trying to figure out, okay, we're picking up colors here. What were the original colors? Because, you know, a 70-year-old jacket's going to have some yellowing in different colors sure. than it did the day it was printed, you know. But people respond to that and absolutely love it. And I think you should have, and I that's a part that I've always agreed with, and that's why I've always put so much effort into it. I think the whole experience should just be as authentic as possible, as high quality as possible, and as archive quality as possible.
I mean, I've always, like, I always had a turntable. I never disconnected my turntable. You know, I probably started picking up more Record Store Day stuff in the teens. And then, you know, around the pandemic, when I couldn't go out to shows, is when I sort of upgraded my turntable and then really kind of started getting sucked into getting deeper into the Steve Hoffman forums and, you know, joined Vinyl Me Please before it totally, you know, I'm not even going to get into what happened with them. But, you know, there would be a lot, but I would see a lot of debates about like the tip-on jackets versus direct-to-board and stuff. And honestly, I never noticed what they were. I didn't know what they were. Now I know what they are, but it wasn't something that was like important to me. And it is interesting that I see, because I see what you see. I see a lot of people, they'll get mad if something, you know, doesn't have the tip-on jacket, even though then they'll also complain that the Rhino high fidelity tip-on jacket, it's hard to get the record into because it's stiffer. So it kind of plays both ways. But, you know, people also are always comparing everything to their OG copy. Like, well, this sounds great, but, you know, the original British vinyl first press of this record is still the definitive one. And that's not 180. That's a standard. Those old 70s way. Records they're comparing them to are these standard weight
right.
records.
Well, the other thing that really comes into play here from any time period, certainly today, but I mean, going back decades, you know, the other thing that really matters a lot, aside from the vinyl weight, is the formula and how clean and pure the formula itself
right.
is. And you know this because you see some super formulas and some things like that today. I can't remember. They call it Neotech or something. But the bottom line is that every pressing plant, their calling card is going to be their black 180, in some cases 200, but it's like, okay, this is our premium formula. And it's very interesting. Gotta Grooves black 180 is a proprietary formula. The noise floor on it is dead quiet. And what's very interesting to me that talks about how important the formula is Matt Early's a fascinating guy. I was doing an Everclear record, Songs from an American Movie, last year. The artist, in this case, Art Alexakis, wanted to do colored vinyl, which I'd never done. And I'd never done it because everybody told me at the pressing plants and everywhere that it can't be as quiet. You know, what I just said, black 180 is our premium. It's a formula we know. It's the one we go to bat with. It's our premium product. Everything else is kind of a bet. Well, what Matt shared with me, so first I was going to Matt only to get ammunition to be able to try to talk Art Alexakis out of Colored Vinyl.
Right.
And Matt shocked me and went, well, if you do transparent colors, I can make it as quiet as black 180. I said, prove it. So he was working on some test pressings for me of my first album, the first album on Intervention, IR001, with Steeler's Wheel, was Stuck in the Middle. It's an amazing sounding record. I know it like the back of my hand. I still remember the goosebumps I got the first time I sat in Kevin Gray's studio and that tape rolled up. And I went, oh my God, I'm in the record business, as I was hearing Jerry Rafferty and Joe Egan's voices. And anyway, he sent me black 180 and transparent 140. And whatever differences there were between the two, I wouldn't have wanted to make a living picking them out. And I just said, I can't believe this is amazing. So what that really tells me is, again, the vinyl formula itself more than the weight. If you got a quiet formula that you could do well, that carries a lot of it. And over the years, the different decades, I mean, you know, people throw shade all the time. It's funny. I've talked to some record collector friends. The old Dynaflex records that are like wafer thin.
Right. RCA.
They sound great.
All those old Harry Nilsson records.
Exactly. Nilsson, Bowie, Lou Reed.
Right.
And they're cracker thin. They sound amazing. And a big part of that's got to be and then conversely, right? In the 80s, when the record companies were trying to get everybody to go to the CD, I think it's pretty well known, and I think it's true, that they started melting old records, labels, dirt, crud and all, and making vinyl out of that. And then going, look how awful vinyl sounds. You hear all those clicks and pops and how terrible it is. I mean, because let's face it, there's some great records from the 80s that you just can't find a quiet pressing of. And that's also during that time period is when you started seeing the Virgin Vinyl as a branding, not just a branding exercise. They were saying, hey, we didn't chuck a bunch of old records into the furnace to make this record.
Right.
You know, so that's a big part of it. And it's very interesting too, because I know one thing that is actually real when you start getting, you know, it's a weird thing because the other half of my, you know, life and in music and audio is in the high-end audio industry. And when you do get to that level, one of the things they say is that 180 gram vinyl is less prone to resonances while the album's actually playing due to the weight. In mass, you know, that might be somewhat true. I'm just saying, like, the differences that I've heard in doing direct comparisons with my own test pressings, I have to squint, and any differences might just be the minute difference are in the noise floor of the back of the arm will be up a little higher on 150 gram because it's a thinner record. The differences were that close.
Have you gotten feedback from customers that they want to pay $5 less, and, you know, even if they're losing, you know,
What? Because the only way I could have made him $5 less was to do the direct to boards jackets. And the feedback I got directly was, I'd rather pay 40 and get a nice jacket.
Right. So really, it's just a matter of, is this an expense that's actually helping the quality of this product?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it was really, I was a little surprised, but not entirely surprised. So, you know, I'm still doing my best. I've got, you know, some of these things for a variety of the reasons I've already named, like, really have to peak over $40. And it's interesting you mentioned, you know, VMP, because at the time when they were really still blowing and going, and they were doing some releases under their different sub-labels, kind of like I do, Tip on Jackets and All Analog and all that stuff. Their stuff started to, you know, the bottom line is I had to, some of my single 33s have had to, you know, migrate upward to like $43. You know, and whenever that's warranted, I mean, I'll do it. I mean, some of the new releases were tough. You know, the other thing that's very interesting is I think, you know, to laypersons, and I say layperson, that's not a good term, but like, let's say maybe a more general, like, music buying population, not the initiated who know my label and know my stuff, right? 180 might carry a little more cachet.
Sure.
Because I think they kind of hear, like, I think in their mind, they just go 180 means quality. they don't necessarily understand why. They don't understand the, you know, I get that. So I think where I would kind of prefer to be doing everything at 150, I am begrudgingly acknowledging, you know, for some projects, I'll stick with 180 because for marketing purposes, just to communicate to people that I spent all the money I could on the quality, even though I'm not, you know, I can't look them in the eye and tell them that if I'd have done it on 150, that it would sound any different or better, because I don't think that's true.
So you just hit the 10th anniversary of Intervention, right? Like your first, were your first albums like
that's
October?
That's a really good question. Yes, that's very good.
October 25th, 2015 is when Discogs has you doing the first one. So
and it's true. So Steeler's Wheel came out in November of, so the summer of 15 is when I, Kevin Gray and I cut six or seven different records. The first group of, it was Joe Jackson, two Steeler's Wheel titles, three Joe Jacksons, and two Everclears. And we cut them all that summer. Steeler's Wheel is the only one that made it out in 15, but that's right. I didn't even think, Mark, I missed my own 10th anniversary.
This is your anniversary special. This is your 10th anniversary special, and we're going to celebrate.
I'm going to send that to my social media and email, an email blast team. So, well, I'll tell you what. We're kind of celebrating the 10th with a bang, because like I said, this business is so feast or famine with titles. I had one fall through that would have come out last spring, and then I had nothing, and now I'm working on, you know, four or five different titles, and I just announced, you know, the dance album of Carl Perkins, you know, my Sun record, the Intervention Records, Sun Records Hi-Fi series of Sun originals remastered from tape to vinyl. But yeah, Johnny Cash with his Hot and Blue guitar, Johnny's original, his first LP, 1957.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And it's, so you sent me advances of these, like the test presents, just so I could check them out. And I was in Sun Studios a few summers ago. I'd never been to Memphis before. And I picked up Dance Album of Carl Perkins. So I have the version that they put out. So of course I had to.
It wasn't there. My understanding is it wasn't theirs. I believe that was a third party label.
Right. Yeah, they didn't, yeah. But they sold it at the, you know, they have everyone is a gift shop. So you do the tour, you go to the gift shop.
Yeah.
I'm like, I have to get a record at Sun Records. And that's the one I bought, because that Carl Perkins album is like a greatest hits album, but it's just an album. I mean, there's so much stuff on there that's even my kid comes out and hears Honey Don't. I'm like, oh, that's a new movie. I'm like, yeah, it's Beatles song. It's Carl Perkins song. But yeah, so we A-B'd yours versus that one. And I had my wife listen. She's like, oh no, the second one is like, there's a lot more on this happening. It's much fuller. And so, you know, your layperson and your more seasoned person both agree that what you did and Kevin Gray did is, you know, really good.
Well, and look, you know, the credit back in it goes all the way back to Sam Phillips. I mean, what a recording engineer. Because the thing that blew me away, you know, these projects have just really been amazing. And I had the same experience. I knew so many different Carl Perkins songs, and I knew them from the Beatles covers and all that. I did not know they were on one album. Like, all the ones that you really know are on this album.
And you're right. Everybody's trying to be my baby.
Well, his cover of Only You, which is remarkable in its own way. You know, Matchbox.
Right.
Gone, Gone, Gone. You know, Honey Don't. Everybody's trying to be my baby. I knew, you know, I'm a huge fan of the Johnny Cash Unearthed series that he did with Rick Rubin, and he did an amazing cover of Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby. You know, and I didn't even know then that Carl Perkins toured with Johnny and was a guitar player on Folsom Prison and Live at San Quentin, which just blows my mind.
Oh, I didn't know that
either. But you're very correct in terms of being a compilation, because Carl's career happened primarily during the singles era. And that's what they did in 1957, was they assembled his singles to put out an LP. And it's very funny. I mean, one of the things that you might or might not notice, the previous reissue didn't do this, but the very first jackets have several songs on the front cover, like his kind of call outs, including a song that was never on the album called All Mama's Children. So thankfully, I got permission from Sun Records. I said, I really want to keep this authentic to the original pressings that came out, and I want to keep that song on the front cover and not put it on the album. Yeah, but I was blown, you know, when Sun, and this is another thing that blows my mind, Sun, the good folks at Sun, Chase Gregory and the other folks I work with there who are wonderful. We had discussed some other projects previously that didn't come to fruition, but they remembered talking to me and we had some great talks and I was very fond of the whole team over there. And apparently they felt the same way and they called me in August and they said, look, we're looking for a partner to do what they called hi-fi releases. So yes, I totally stole the whole idea from the, you know, Sun Records, the Intervention Records Sun Hi-Fi series, stole it directly from the way they referred to it. But they said, we're looking for a partner to do hi-fi releases. We got some really important anniversaries coming up. And they said the first one that, you know, and this is, Mark, this is August, right? They're like, this December is the 70th anniversary of Blue Suede Shoes being recorded. It was recorded in December of 55 and released on New Year's Day of 56 as a single. And it's an important, I mean, for rock and roll history, right? It's one of the most important anniversaries there is. Do you think you could get a product to market by December?
This was August of this year?
Yeah. And I said, okay. I said, so first of all, I had a title canceled. There's another one that I was supposed to be in production on now that's been pushed back because our remix is being done. I said, so the dance card cleared up. And I said, listen, if everything goes right, we have a shot. That's the best I could do. And you know, the first thing is like, okay, you've got the will. You want to do a reissue. Everybody does. I get it. But do you have tapes? And if you have, how do they sound? And the bottom line is, Kevin Gray and I were just looking at each other when we were cutting these things. I don't think anyone's ever heard what they put on these tapes until this issue, because there's so much, they're so dynamic. They're, you know, they're all mono, you know, but the dynamics are crazy. The feeling that you get when the air is charged and you feel like the musicians are in the room with you,
right.
Sam absolutely got that on tape. I mean, I really feel, you know, and these were short mono programs. We were unbelievably able to fit both of them onto a single 12-inch LP at 45 RPM. There isn't any other way that we could make these sound better at any price. There really isn't. And I was blown away by just the liveliness and the way that, you know, that feeling you get when the air is kind of charged and you really feel that you're in the recording space. This is as close as a time machine back to 1955 and 1956 is I think you're going to get. And I don't think people have heard this incredible music revealed this much. You know, the famous Sun Studios, you know, sound, you know, Sam Phillips developed that slapback thing with, you know, where he stacked his tape machines and got that slapback echo, like on the Johnny Cash. I mean, that's a huge part of what gives his voice in those Sun Records that ethereal, you know, Colin Escott, the Sun historian, who's been just an absolute godsend and helped me with consulting, writing the liner notes. You know, he'd been in the Sun vaults. And one of the first things I wanted to find out is like, hey, has anybody cut this stuff from tape before? When was the last time they did this? And are these the tapes? Or, you know, you'd always hear these rumors. Well, you know, there are master tapes, but we haven't seen them since the 80s or this or that. And the answer really is no. Like, since at least the 80s, these tapes that they had, which were 7-inch singles, just compiled onto reels willy-nilly all over the place. Those are the masters. Those are the surviving masters. That's the best there is. And, you know, so there weren't any rumors about tapes that had gone missing and there were no compiled masters. So, I mean, these things really hadn't been done analog tape to vinyl since at least like the 80s.
Wow, that's crazy. And these yes. albums are so short. I mean, a lot of those early records are like 27 minutes, you know? So you can just put it on 45, not have to do it on four sides and getting up every, you know, 8 minutes or 5 minutes. And
well, and that's the thing.
You hear the whole side of music with all six songs or whatever, and flip it, but it's 45 and it just sounds better.
Well, and this was just unbelievable. So first of all, I wouldn't have cut them as double 45s because I didn't want to charge people $60 for these. They would have been single 33s. But, you know, the thing is this. Kevin and I, so one of the programs is 27 minutes, and I think the other one might be 31. But the thing you also don't know is, like, is there one, and there was one side, I think it was on Carl Perkins, that pushed like 15 minutes, which is the hairy edge. And you don't know until Kevin does. So the first thing we do, we sit down to mastering, is we do what we call the rundown, which is we go through and we settle on all the EQ choices and levels. And that's where, if we have original, which I always do, you know, to answer your question earlier, you were talking about, okay, for this record, the original UK is the God copy or the, you know, whatever. I go to every mastering session myself. I sit there with Kevin. Kevin's in charge, but like I have input. He's very generous in his time and letting me go back and forth and hear different EQ choices, compare it to the, you know, again, I take the best sounding version that there is and I make sure we're going to beat it, you know, and I'm not trying to recreate that. I'm trying to be faithful to what's on the tapes, but I want to make sure also that it doesn't, you know, and it's only happened in a couple of instances where you're like, okay, wow, this is so far afield from what the original LP sound like. We also don't want to give something to people, an album they love, in a way that's totally unfamiliar. Unfortunately, that's never really happened. But that's generally what we do. And so you make all these EQ choices, and then you got to do a dry run, where basically he starts the tapes, the lathe, at the levels that it's at the EQ it's at, and the lathe moves just like it's cutting, but it's not cutting. And you basically make sure that you don't run out of room.
Right.
We didn't know until the first dry run of both sides of each of these albums that we could make it fit without altering in any way the level or EQ choices that we made. Because the two things that you would have to do is like, okay, if you're almost going to make it, but not quite, there are a couple things you could do. The most benign would be you could filter the bass below 30 cycles because there's not very much real fundamentals down there, and you don't end up hearing it like the bass is cut. It still sounds full and rich. It's just a gentle slope at the very bottom. The other thing would be messing around with the levels, which to some degree or another would be audible one way or another. And in both of these cases, it was just the luck of the draw, frankly. They both fit easily and beautifully, and we were just absolutely thrilled because at 45 RPMs, these things are a really crazy You Are There in Sun Studios experience.
Right. The wild card is how much, and I've just been learning about this a little bit, like how wide the grooves are kind of depends on how bass heavy the music was recorded in the first place, and so the width of the grooves can vary. So really, until you cut it, you don't know how much space it's going to take up. So it sounds like you just kind of nailed it.
Well, and again, I was not going to compromise the Sonics just to get 45. I did not have in my head that this has to be at 45 and we're going to make it work, hell or high water, at 45. I want to make the best sounding choice, and I would have been happy with it at 33. It was just fortunate because we didn't have to alter any of our choices one tiny bit. So it's absolutely maximum fidelity.
How many Sun titles are you doing total?
So I could say thus far, we've got two announced, and there are definitely two more that are coming next year.
And are they all in that, you know, 50s time frame?
So far. I will say that there's, in all of my talks with the Sun folks, there is something that they shared with me that I was not familiar with from the late 60s, and I don't want to give it away right now, but it blew my mind. It's not something that people know very well. I'll just say that it just kind of blew my mind. And there might be something from a slightly later era, but in this hi-fi series, these are the 50s originals.
And they're going to all be
where they've got analog master tapes.
Are they all going to be at 45, or is that to be determined?
To be determined. And it'll be determined exactly the way that we did this one. So, you know, what preceded getting in with Kevin is weeks of... Now, the Sun folks, they had done their own reissue of Hot and Blue Guitar a few years ago. And they had done a compilation of Carl Perkins called King of Rockabilly. That's wonderful. And by the way, I should just say this, because obviously I started up putting my antenna up to all things Carl Perkins the last few months. Carl's got a new record that's either already out or about to come out. That's some stuff that he recorded in the late 80s. And it's absolutely delightful. It just sounds like he took his 50 sound and picked it up where he left off. And it's really wonderful. And apparently he's got a son, and, you know, I would love it if he at least heard it and heard what, and really, frankly, like, hey, this is what your dad did in the 50s. And, you know, this Carl's music at that time was so new that it, like, rockabilly didn't even have a name. It was so cutting edge at the time. And like, you know, it's been an education talking to Colin Escott, who did, you know, this is the first time I've ever done liner notes. And they're actually posted on the website, on the webpage for Dance Album of Carl Perkins. Colin Escott wrote these wonderful notes. And yeah, I mean, the bottom line is Dance Album of Carl Perkins was rock and roll to the Beatles.
Absolutely, yeah.
They covered as a band or solo all 12 of the songs on this album at different times. And, you know, what's really interesting is probably like a lot of people, I was very familiar with a lot of the covers. And when, you know, hearing these tapes and the quality, Carl's versions have a life and an energy that are just infectious. When they first approached me with this, I was sitting there and I'm like, okay, I've never done anything this old. I've never done a mono record. I've not been opposed to it, but it's like, I'm really known a lot for a lot of 70s to 90s stuff that has kind of fallen through the cracks.
Yeah. I mean, when you founded the label, it was really like, we're going to do stuff from the 80s on, because that's the stuff that hasn't been reissued to death.
Yeah. That has been a focus as much as possible, but I've never shied away from things that I just love. And if there's a lane to do it, I'll do it. I mean, you know, so like the Flying Burrito Brothers falls into that category. You know, I grew up with that music. My uncle introduced me to it, and it was interesting. My uncle was very into like the later era kind of weird Burrito Brothers stuff and all country before it had a name in the late 70s, you know, Jerry Jeff Walker, David Allen Coe. You know, in the Bay Area where I grew up, there was a all country station called KFAT, I think it was called, out of Gilroy. And my uncle was just into all this stuff. You know, he was the one who first played me Gunfighter Ballads, Marty Robbins, you know, and he was just into this stuff that in the late 70s, at least, was a little, you know, offbeat. And then later is when I discovered, you know, the Gram Parsons era, Graham's place in rock and roll history, you know, the work he did with the Flying Burrito Brothers, International Submarine, and then the Stones, right? And then Gene Clark, you know, who Michael Fremmer introduced me to. I'd heard a couple of Gene Clark songs. I was visiting Michael Fremmer once. And he goes, oh, have you ever heard that on vinyl? That got me into Dillard and Clark. So I ended up doing a, you know, so it's weird, right? Like nobody would have looked at my Matthew Sweet and Everclear and said, oh, that guy's going to go do a bunch of country rock stuff like Gene Clark and Dillard and Clark, Flying Burrito Brothers, or for that matter, Judy Sill. But, you know, when things come up and I get a feel for it, I get all in. And again, like with Carl, I probably knew the covers more than I knew him. And then I listened to his versions and I just went, oh, my God. Like, and the other first thing was like being invited into being a steward of iconic releases in rock and roll history. I can tell you, I take that very seriously. I never thought the voice of Johnny Cash would be on Intervention Records or Carl Perkins. And I am just having a blast. We've worked so slavishly hard. You know, this is the first time I've really been in that, like, okay, the collectors who are going to want the authentic, I've worked harder than ever with my artist, Tom Vodikin, And again, Colin Escott and Hank Davis have been helping me out a lot. We've put more effort into getting the colors right on the jackets, the center labels. You know, some of the reissues that have come out use a Sun label that's got the rooster on the logo. That was a label that was used for 78s, not LPs. The LP logos on the center labels just had the sun rays. So we've just taken every effort to make these as beautiful and authentic as possible. And I really feel that because I've always done that. But in this case, you know, this is rock and country history that I'm working with here. And I'm very cognizant of that.
Sounds like this came up at a good time for you too, because you had something that fell through, something that was delayed, you know, maybe it was sort of a dry spell. Like what was going on at some point
totally
before this came up?
Well, frankly, a lot of frustration, because I worked for months on a title, and eventually just had some differences, you know, with the artists involved and just had to cancel it, which I felt very unfortunate about. And I'm working on another project that I'm really hoping also will get an announcement out by the end of the year. That's going to be great. It's another 80s title. It's a band and an artist that I've got a very personal connection to, working directly with one of the guys in the band who's a wonderful guy. It's been a great experience. But it's a case where he wanted to remix the whole album. He wanted to do it himself. And it's just taken more time. It's like, hey, you can't hurry that. Like, it's like, okay, let's put it. So yeah, and then I've been going through this process where I've had Gilded Palace of Sin by the Flying Burrito Brothers in print for 8 years. And I was denied an extension because the label wants to do their own. Now, the label had done their own version in 2022. And they coexisted. They're not exclusive licenses, but you know, I've been getting turned down for some stuff that I've had in print for a long time and wanted to be a part of my catalog. And you know, I'm not very easily discouraged, which is why I've been able to hang on for, you know, 10 years in this business. But yeah, I was a little discouraged and I needed a little shot in the arm, to tell you the truth, because lately it's been, you know, I can't, due to pricing and other things, I can't get my Matthew Sweet vinyl back in the market. The Church Starfish, same thing. They basically, you know, nearly doubled the prices to a point where they'd have to be, you know, $60. And it's like, you know, these have been in the market for years as $40, $45 titles with a lot of value. It just didn't make sense for me financially. And I just had to say no to some of those things too and just look and go, wow, am I going to be able to keep this thing going? You know, I don't have the deep pockets and big businesses behind my business the way that a couple of my competitors do. And credit to them. They built these big, wonderful businesses that support their ventures in record making, because it really is a cash intensive, low volume business when it comes down to it.
10 years ago, you launched this label, and now you're trying to sort of renew, you know, some of these contracts and stuff. What was the industry like then and now? Like, for certainly vinyl wasn't where it is now back in 2015.
No, it wasn't much easier then. But, you know, the impetus, you know, for me to start the label really is there was a hole in the market, I felt, for people who had the taste in music that I do and would be willing to spend a premium price for an archive quality copy of stuff from the 70s, 80s, and 90s that really had not been mined as deeply as the rest of the rock and roll, you know, canon, right? There used to be a label that I loved called Classic Records, run by a guy named Mike Hobson, that did a remarkable breadth of titles. And my God, if I could ever go back, like, you know, I'm so jealous of Mike because, you know, in the 90s and 2000, when vinyl was dead, you could damn near get anything in terms of licensing, right? So he got Led Zeppelin, The Who, he got, you know, Peter Gabriel. But the thing that I loved about what Mike did, like the Peter Gabriel catalog is a great example. That's a very, that's a near and dear, catalog to my heart. I've got all the classic reissues. I got the original UK Charismas. I love Peter Gabriel. And frankly, Peter Gabriel era Genesis also, right? And Mike got to do all that stuff, and he did it just spectacularly. You know, he had Bernie Grundman cutting from tape and just did great work. Well, classic went away, and I didn't feel like anyone was picking up that mantle, because he did a lot of very interesting 90s and even early 2000s contemporary alternative music. You know, he was he somehow had a deal. He even did the original pressings of Matthew Sweet's stuff on vinyl in the 90s. It was some collaboration with Zoo Records or something, where they did the vinyl through Classic. And Mike did it, but, like, you know, he did Sarah McLachlan. I mean, off the top of my head, he did Dido. He did Sarah McLachlan. So many interesting things. And when Classic stopped, nobody else was going to do that stuff. And I was crazy enough to think that I could. And I have. It's still 10 years later. I don't know financially if I'm better for it. But I've had the time of my life doing it.
What was it easier then to... I mean, again, nothing's easy, especially when you're just starting up, you know, a label and you're like, I'm doing three Joe Jackson titles, but, you know, you're getting licenses for these titles. Would they allow you to press a certain number then? And is it similar now, or has that become,
well,
the numbers change, the costs change?
Well, this is very interesting. So to some extent here, let me know when I get just too inside baseball, but I'll give you a couple of things that may be of interest. So first of all, Joe Harley, the Tone Poet series, has to take a lot of the credit and blame for getting me in the record business, because he introduced me to his friends. He invited me to mastering to meet Kevin back when he was working with Ron Rombach at Music Matters. Those guys basically taught me the ropes. They're like, this is what a quality reissue is. This is what it is. And I knew enough from being a voracious consumer of reissues by then. Universal Music was where they had their in, and they walked me in the door. Like, hey, this is a friend. He's got the means. He's a serious guy. He'll do it right. He wants to work with you on some reissues. It took 3 years.
And now you were doing what at this point? Like,
I was working for AudioQuest. So I was, Joe Harley also was instrumental in getting me a job over there. So I was in the audio video press for almost 10 years. I worked for the company that published The Absolute Sound and The Perfect Vision. And then I was the editor-in-chief of Home Theater Magazine. That's in that group at the time owned Stereophile also. And then I started working in marketing, communication, PR, on the manufacturing side, first for AudioQuest, and then later for other brands. So at the time when I started making the calls, I was, you know, I had a job in the high, so I had a job in the hi-fi industry, you know, as Joe did too. Joe was at AudioQuest as well until around 2020, and had been for a long, long time. Back in the day, that, you know, 10 years ago, all these things used to be on what are so-called like manufacturing deals, which means you'd go and you'd make a deal, and usually it was like, okay, there's a certain, you commit to a certain unit guarantee over 3 years, an opening run of this many, represses of this many. And to be honest, I'll tell you, okay, like typical deals back then were like 2,000 unit guarantee, 1,000 opening order, 500 unit represses, and so forth. So, and then it was a so-called manufacturing deal. And all that means is that, like, you tell them where you want to press. You're responsible for the artwork and the jackets, the mat. You know, you tell them where you want the tape sent, stuff like that. Or if you want tape, which a lot of labels don't. I do, obviously. So then it's a manufacturing deal. They give you an all-in price that covers, you know, like in my case, Black 180 at RTI, all your royalties and publishing mechanicals, as they call them. It's X amount of dollars per unit. Like, there's your price, you know, and that's what you pay, right? So everybody worked on that basis for a long time, till around 2020, when things got crazy during the pandemic and nobody could get records pressed. Things went to licensing deals. And in the case of a licensing deal, you pay the royalties. They don't care about where you're going to manufacture stuff like that, but you still got to tell them, I'm going to do it either on black vinyl or colored, you know, and there's kind of things you still have to do, a unit guarantee, and all that. But like, you're no longer like, they don't care what your opening order is, cause they make you pay in advance, based on that. And then you're responsible for the publishing or mechanicals, and the rest of the stuff. So that's kind of the inside baseball and how the deals are structured, like at least a loose picture of it.
Right.
So then you go back, and after it expires, you go, they say, hey, your deal's expiring. And most of the time you just go, yeah, I want a 2 or 3 year extension. And then sometimes that's the other thing that changes when it was manufacturing, represses were pay as you go. Under the new way, when there's an extension, you pay in advance, which is tough because with a repress, you don't have the same velocity as when a title's new. So you'll fork out a bunch of money and it comes back slowly.
So you had a repress of Joe Jackson's Night and Day.
Yeah.
Which I've mentioned to you in an email, like I'll have friends over and I'll say, listen to this. And I'll put that on. And like, if I want to show off my, you know, my system or whatever, just listen to something that sounds cool. Like here's an album that we know from, you know, college or after or whatever. You never heard, you know, the percussion in Chinatown pop out like you do on that version.
Right.
Matthew Sweet, I owned, you know, like a lot of people, I owned Girlfriend on CD. Altered Beast, I owned on CD. So I got the first vinyl versions of it through you, and they sound great.
Yeah. You know, Joe Jackson, that's a very interesting one. Of all the first titles, that was the one I was most, well, I shouldn't say most, but I was very nervous because the original A&M, in the bottom line is Night and Day is a brilliant recording. And the original A&M is great. But you know, the bottom line is that, like, again, Kevin's chain is so transparent. It really gets, it's the most open window to the tape. You know, it's just so incredible. And between that, and again, you know, doing it in boutique processes, and, you know, like there's an example of, right, of another way I approach these things. Night and Day was originally a single jacket with an insert. I think it was one of the inserts where the vinyl would go into a sleeve with lyrics and stuff printed on both sides. I'm very prone to redoing those as single pocket gatefolds, where you open this beautiful gatefold and the stuff that used to be on the inner sleeve is reprinted there. It's just, so yeah, it's a premium product. But the other thing is, like, I don't earn my bones if it doesn't sound the best it's ever sounded or will sound. And with that one, I just knew we had our work cut out for us, but we did it.
And you were able to get that one repressed once at least.
Yes. Well, no, several times. You know, that's interesting. There was, for reasons I can't go into, I never stopped asking for extensions on that. There was a while where they weren't granted, and then it got re-granted last year. So I was very thankful to have that one. The Joe Jackson, you know, it's obviously. So the Steeler's Wheel, Joe Jackson, and Everclear titles were always on the very first lists of wants that I sent to Universal in 2012. So the first seven albums were really the stuff I wanted the most. And Joe Jackson to me was a prime example. And it's funny, a lot of people told me I was crazy for doing it. They said, why the hell are you doing these? Because nobody's going to buy these for $40 when you can get them used for $5. I said, not like this, they can't. These albums are, I know there's more on the tapes. And like Night and Day, Look Sharp, and I'm the Man, they're worth it to Joe Jackson fans. I knew Joe's catalog was worth it.
Yeah, I have Look Sharp and Night and Day. I think I'm the Man was long gone by the time I was looking into that one.
That's the only one that lapsed and went out of print, because the first go around, you know, when my label was smaller, there were a few titles. I was just talking to somebody about this earlier today. I put some things out that I think if I did it now with the label having the you know, somewhat critical mass that it's got, and the fan base it's got, would have done great, that just didn't back then. And it's just unfortunate, because there are more than a few of those that I really tried to bring back, and I just couldn't do it.
And then Judy Sill is another one who you've pressed a few times, and
yeah,
that's at a higher price point, maybe because they're just such rare records.
No, it's not. In that particular case, and you're starting to see this right now with some other high-profile announcements from other labels, Warner's an interesting case, and the bottom line is that if they're going to do a 33 themselves, or if some other label has a 33, they'll only license 45s. So for Judy, that's all that was available. And I just thought, with her fan base, the era, and oddly, like the 45s with the side breaks and the maximum fidelity, I felt it worked for those titles. You know, now that being said, that's another classic case. you know, the represses on those are extraordinarily, they will come back, but they're very expensive. And again, when you do represses and you get 500 more of these things, they don't fly out the door the way they did when they were first announced, you know? So it's just...
And you have to pay everything in advance, right?
Yeah. Well, in that case, like I said, I don't want to get too inside here, but the bottom line is it's a costly proposition to do represses right. 8 years later. And especially on the $60 double 45s, because my cost in them is so high.
And then you do SACDs too. Like, where does that fit in your business?
Well, you know what? During the pandemic, especially, it was a blessing. I didn't start the business thinking that I would do that. It was really kind of by demand. I do have awareness and have for a long time, but you know, for every, you know, 10 or 15 audiophiles, you know, so to speak, you know, one of them will do vinyl. Most people do digital of some kind. But people were kind of demanding it. And I went up and I just kind of acquiesced. It was funny because we always did a DSD backup, like of, you know, our mastering, like as it goes out to the lathe, that simultaneously goes out to a machine that does a DSD conversion. So we always had these, you know, backups on DSD. So I eventually just started, you know, releasing them where it made sense, right? Like now with Everclear or something from like the grunge era where it's like, okay, you can get a cheap CD on Amazon. Didn't make sense, I don't think. You know, I don't think Everclear's audience is going to buy a high-end digital physical product. Matthew Sweet has been a little more balanced. Like Girlfriend does really, really well on SACD. The other two, not so much. You know, Girlfriend's quite a bit more popular than his other. I don't get it personally because I think Altered Beast, especially, is extraordinary. And it's interesting. In the '90s, 100% Fun was my favorite of the three. I later sort of jumbled those around in order, but I mean, Girlfriend does well in SACD. The others don't. You know, it's just hit and miss. And it's funny. The SACD ceiling is a little small. Like if you have a weird hit with vinyl, you could do thousands of copies, like if it's just the right thing. Like Starfish did extraordinarily well. You know, Gilded Palace of Sin. I obviously thought I was going to do well enough with it that I went ahead and put it out on vinyl. I would have never guessed that I'd have sold as many of those as I have.
I found that one at a record store in Milwaukee, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to get this, and I did. Sounds that and Dillard and Clark.
I'm so glad. Those are such great albums. And the other one, you know, it's funny. I was just talking to Colin Escott about this. Burrito Deluxe is so underrated. That album has just grown and grown on me over time. I won't say it's as iconic or great as Gilded Palace, but damn, is it great and fun to listen to.
See, now I haven't done that. There's always like one. I picked up Altered Beast and Girlfriend, but I did not pick up 100% Fun. Now I'm kind of kicking myself on it. I got Gilded Palace, did not get Burrito Deluxe. So, you know, I can't be completist, but I should swing back and check that one out.
Oh, yeah, you definitely shouldn't miss those. But, you know, the Matthew Sweets, so the SACD, like Billy Squire does great on SACD. The Church does great on SACD. You know, it's very interesting to me to see how these things go. You know, I ended up doing an SACD only project a few years ago that came to me through Kevin Gray, which was the Quincy Jones album, The Dude.
All right.
Which was a delight. And it was just the weirdest thing that it ended up falling into my lap. You know, so you never know. And I will say this, like I said, I wherever it makes sense and I feel like there's a reasonable expectation of return, I do hybrid CD, SACD releases. And it's very fascinating. In my own straw polls with my online guys, half of them or so buy those for the CD layers. So a lot of people want a remastered CD. They want a physical thing.
They just want the best CD possible.
Yeah. Yeah, they want digital, but they want a physical thing, not a stream.
Yeah. Well, I've always been like, I want to own my music. That's just, you know, and then they start messing with licenses and you're like, wait, I thought I subscribed to this. I thought this was available. Like, no, I mean, maybe it's my hoarding personality, but I like to own what I, you know, my music.
Well, here's a thing for you too. Sometime, if you ever get a chance, take a well-mastered CD of something you like and play it on a CD player and then play a high-res stream. You might end up being surprised.
You think the high-res stream will be better?
No, I don't.
And I've always thought that CDs were like a very effective storage unit on top of everything else.
You know what? I'll tell you this. First of all, I was very, in the early 2000s, I was very front and center for the format war between SACD and DVD audio, which, big surprise, ended up being won by MP3. So, you know, nobody bought into that in the mass market. But I loved the sound of SACD because it sounded more relaxed and more analog-like to me. I will say that well-mastered CDs sound extraordinarily good. And I'll just say I'm not the only one of my like golden ear friends who are all kind of going like, well, you know, if you put a CD on and you compare it, it's kind of interesting. I don't know how to explain that. I don't know how defensible it is, but even well-mastered CDs can sound better than high-res streams.
Sure. No, I believe that. I talked with Peter Frampton when you did your Frampton at 50 box. How closely did you work with him on that?
Oh my gosh. Well, as you probably know, I work directly with the artists as much as possible. In fact, I've lost some projects because I got a deal in place and then went to the artists and said, hey, I'd really like to work with you on this. Artist approved. You could be as involved as much or as little as you want. I'm going to pay for it. It's all on me. I just, you know, I'd love your blessing and to be part of the promotion and everything. And I've had that blow up in my face. I've had artists go, no, like, why are you using our stuff to make money? You know, and kind of,
why are you making us sound good?
Right. Like, yeah, seriously, that's part of the pitch. I'm like, hey, they have the master tapes because I don't set up a deal until I know there's tapes. And I'm going to do this all analog. It's going to be the best thing for the fans, you know, and look, sometimes it goes sideways. But Peter was one of the cases. Billy Squire's another one. Billy's an audiophile. Peter was involved in every single aspect. He saw and approved everything personally. The test pressings, he and Chuck Einle listened to the test pressings and approved the test pressings. All of the art, the inserts, like Peter was absolutely hands-on with everything and was an absolute, one of the most wonderful working experiences I've ever had with an artist. He was an absolute dream to work with. And his manager, Lisa Jenkins, she was the manager at the time. It was one of those things, a fan, so to speak, who's a music professor, connected us and said, oh, I know Peter Frampton's manager. They'd love to do vinyl. And I'm like, I've heard that 1,000 times. You know, you go to management and they're like, well, how much is in it for us? And what does this look like? And why are you, you know, like, well, you know, we can't make enough money because our deal is bad. We're going to back out. You know, Lisa was like, oh my God. Yeah. Like nobody's doing anything for the 50th anniversary of Peter's, you know, solo career. And I was like, you gotta be kidding me. You know, cause look, I mean, that's the music that became Frampton Comes Alive. And the studio recordings are spectacular. And it really, like, you know, those three albums that I did were the ones to me that were like, okay, this is Peter's growth trajectory as an artist into icon status.
Right.
And I just, that's one of the best projects I've ever done. And in particular, working with Peter, I've never had an artist put so much into promoting our work together. He did video. He was tireless.
He talked to me, so that was good. So Frampton Comes Alive, not available for intervention, I assume.
I wish, you know, so many people were so kind enough to hear what we did with Peter's box set, love it, and say the same thing. You know, and I even made a pitch to Peter, and I understand it, you know, that the label wants to keep that one for themselves. I offered to even just help as a reissue producer for free. I said, I'd just love to make sure that the best possible, no corners are cut, and the best possible version of this album makes it to the fans. You know, but I look, the bottom line is I think they'll, I hope, I'm crossing my fingers that they'll do justice to that album on, cause the anniversary is coming up next year. So, I really hope they knock it out of the park. And by the way, I've done that a number of times. You know, I've talked to artists. I said, hey, look, even though we can't work together, you want to call me and bounce stuff off idea. Like I'll tell you anything I know for free. Cause at the end of the day, even if I can't do it myself, I want somebody to do it right. I mean, that's the thing I appreciate about like what, Chad Kasem is doing, what the Bloom, well, Joe Harley's the one who taught me how to do it. So it's not a surprise that the Tone Poet and even Tone Poet Classic are what they are, but like, Chad gets a lot of stuff that I would love to do in the rock world. And I'm like, Chad, you're a blues guy. Let me have all the rock and roll. But the bottom line is like, Chad's just got the resources and gets a lot of amazing stuff. He does it like I would do it. He does it really, really well. He's doing full three-step processing. He's doing great quiet vinyl, really paying a lot of attention to the quality artwork and the packaging and stuff. So it's like, like I said, if I can't, Rhino High Fidelity, same thing. there's a lot of those titles I did ask for and would have killed or died to do. But I love that they're doing them. And let me say this too, in this day and age, I love that they're doing them for $40. Cause I know a lot of people getting priced out. I'm very proud. It's funny because I'll tell you, for Carl Perkins and Johnny Cash, I did talk to Matt early at Gotta Groove. I said, is there anything extra we can do? Have you been working on a new vinyl formula? Is there anything in plating and processing we could do different? Is there any way I could make this sound better? And the bottom line is that's when Matt said, look, I've heard the other formulas out there. I think you love mine for a reason. I said, yeah. I said, I hear it. The noise, the background noise on Matt's records is vanishing. I don't think there's a quieter formulation that's out there at any price. And his consistency is unbelievable. And the bottom line was the only thing that could have been done ended up being the luck of the draw in mastering, which is they fit on 45 without changing a thing. Right. And I'm very proud of the fact I really believe in this day and age that some other labels out there would have grabbed these and tried to do $100 versions of these. I want more people to experience it. The Sun Records, everybody knows Sun Records. They know that, and again, Johnny Cash, this is the album that's got I Walk the Line, Folsom Prison Blues, Cry, Cry, Cry. Right. I mean, these are like songs that Johnny played for the rest of his career. It's one of his most iconic releases of all time. I'm very proud that people are going to hear what they really put on tape in the 50s, and they'll be able to do it for $43. That's a big deal to me, and hopefully to a lot of other people, too.
Do you have a white whale, by the way, like that one album you really want to put out on Intervention?
Oh, of course I do. There's so many of them, but there is one that's above all the others. And I worry every time I say this, because eventually somebody else is going to go out there and do it instead. But the one for me is Jerry Rafferty, City to City.
Has that not been done?
They did a reissue a couple of years ago. It's on colored vinyl or something, and it's okay. I just had to sit there and I'm like, I know what I heard with the tapes on Steeler's Wheel. And I just imagined myself sitting there and mastering and hearing that record and knowing what, Kevin and I could do with a title like that. It would probably be a double. That was one I was hands down. I'm all in. I need this as a double 45 because I know somebody else did it as 33s. That one to me, for reasons I can't even quite discern, I love that album. And Jerry Rafferty to me is, that was a huge album. It changed his life, made him a star forever. But I just thought that guy was spectacular. I thought he had an amazing voice. I thought he wrote some great songs. And I sort of feel like, I just don't know if Jerry, let's put it this way. In the reissue market, I felt like Jerry deserved more than he got. And I did my best. I did two Steeler's Wheel albums.
Right. Yeah, you did the Steeler's Wheel 10 years ago. So have you been trying to do this one? Is there some impasse on that? Because it seems like a logical thing for you to do.
I know it does. Well, it's a different label, and apparently the rights with it reside over in the UK, and it's just a question of how to, like, logistically talk to people over there and put a deal together. So
you just send them your Sealer's Wheel and say, look, I've made them sound great before. This is the iconic Baker Street album.
Dude, I believe me, I did that. You know, at some point, I every chance I've gotten, I send care packages out to any of these people at the label and go, this is my calling card. This is what I'm going to do. It's going to make, you know, because look, I don't have a place in this industry if I don't do something that the artists and the labels can be proud of with their catalog. So I really have to do that. And I consistently do. And, you know, I will tell you this, I'm just very thankful for the times when I show people and they get it. And then they go, yeah, we want this. We want to work with you. The Sun people, it didn't work out the first time. Then they came to me and they said, listen, we've got some things we want to work with. We want the kind of treatment that you do. That meant the world to me. And it's been an amazing working relationship so far.
Nice. It's a labor of love, but you got a lot of labor in there. So
a lot of labor. Yeah. You know, and like I said, I'm at that, you know, I'm still in that uncanny valley, you know, for the most part. I mean, I've got some wonderful, wonderful people. You know, my art director I've been working with this entire time, Tom Vatican, is great. Kevin Gray, obviously, you know, and I've been very fortunate. I've worked with Ryan Smith and Chris Bellman too. Kevin and I just have a lot of shorthand from how much work we've done together. And, we're friends on top of it. I mean, you know, we were doing these Sun records. I don't think we've ever been as like smiled as much. Like we just kept looking at each other, listening to these tapes. And this is the only time Kevin's done that. A really cool guy, a rockabilly guitarist named Deke Dickerson, lives in Kevin's neighborhood. And we were doing Carl Perkins and Johnny Cash. Kevin invited him over just to hang out and like hear what we were doing, which has never happened before. And the cool thing is that Deke turned out to be like, and I hope he didn't butcher his last name. I'm almost positive it's Deke Dickerson. If I screwed that up, I'm going to feel really bad, but I'm terrible with names. Yeah, I will, right? And then it'll be a dub. Like I'll be sitting here and all of a sudden I'll be like, and the right thing will come in, right? But he's the one who identified the proper labels to use, like for the LP. And he turned out to have a tremendous amount of knowledge about, you know, Sun Records and its history. That I didn't have. And it was just, you know, it was great. So, you know, the more we can have, you know, and share those kinds of experiences, you know, the tent gets bigger.
Where are you based?
I'm in Gig Harbor, Washington.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's funny, and people always ask me, right? But it's like, so what does that mean? Well, like Kevin's in LA, so it's a short flight for me to go down and work with Kevin. You know, the pressing plant now is in Ohio. Dornan, at RTI still does my plating and processing. So that's in Camarillo. Stoughton's in City of Industry, which is Los Angeles area. So the bottom line is like, it's all over the place. And then I'm here.
Nice.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. My graphic artist is, Tom, he's my art director. He's based in Southern California. The wonderful ladies, Angela and Jamil, who do my email blasts and social media stuff. They're on the East Coast. They're good friends. So yeah, kind of people, you know what I mean? Like we're all in the laptop class now. So
right.
Anywhere we are, we can just kind of keep this thing rolling.
Well, cool. Well, thanks so much for coming on. I've been wanting to talk to you for a while on this. I remember seeing you at Expona a couple of years ago, but I've been buying your records for a while. I have a pretty good collection of Intervention, and honestly they're more that I wish I had bought. So it's I have no buyer's remorse of anything I bought. It's more like not buyer's remorse that I didn't pick up those extra ones as well. Great talking to Shane.
Mark, I really enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
That's it for episode 204 of Caro Pop. Thanks so much to Shane Bettner for taking us through the ins and outs of his high-end reissues label, Intervention Records. Go to interventionrecords.com to order albums, including the dance album of Carl Perkins, which ships this month, and Johnny Cash with his Hot and Blue Guitar, which ships in February. Keep an eye out for announcements about further Sun Records releases as well. And check out Intervention's other releases currently available, including three of Peter Frampton's early albums collected in the Frampton at 50 box and sold separately, three Everclear albums, 180-gram pressing of Joe Jackson's Body and Soul, a new 150-gram Gotta Groove pressing of Jackson's Night and Day, Gene Clark's White Light and the Fantastic Expedition of Dillard and Clark, and SACDs of titles by Judy Sill, Matthew Sweet, and many others. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swaik, who gives this podcast a vital intervention every week. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. I'll give you a shout out on the next episode. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at carolpop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caro Pop on the so-called socials at Caro Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe here and on YouTube, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caro Pop conversation. Thanks.